Hey, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process and their profession. This week, it is a return guest, Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, WrestlingObserver.com, and a writer for MMAFighting.com. As I have said before, when I interviewed Dave, no one has covered professional wrestling longer and with a more journalistic bent than Dave Meltzer. As part of this 70-minute podcast, I discuss with Dave the upcoming WrestleMania card and why the WWE has set certain matches up and what the creative staff is looking for heading forward post-WrestleMania.
Depending on as far as who wins and loses, I don't know who's going to win and lose, and there's arguments, but if Roman Reigns loses, it's the start of a storyline of a redemption and a comeback. And if he wins, it's going to be tough because the people are going to boo him like crazy. They'll resent him for beating Undertaker, unless the idea is to turn him heel for a while and then turn him back babyface. There's just like so many, it's intriguing. There's so many different ways that you can go with that. But the ultimate goal is Roman Reigns top babyface and face of the company in the 2018 WrestleMania, yes.
We'll also talk about the explosion of wrestling podcasts over the last 24 months. I ask him about the possibility of returns for Hulk Hogan and CM Punk. And we end the podcast with 20 minutes of your questions. And I appreciate those from Twitter, where Dave answers about independent wrestling in North America, how long he thinks John Cena will be around, whether Stephanie McMahon will get back into the ring, and how the McMahon's close relationship and partnership with Donald Trump, Linda McMahon is in the cabinet, how that, if at all, has affected employee morale. That was an interesting question, and Dave had an interesting answer. All right, this is all coming up on a podcast I think you're really going to enjoy. It's Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. All right, and as promised, we bring in Dave Meltzer, and as I gave all his credits at the top, no one has covered professional wrestling longer and with a more journalistic bent than Dave Meltzer. Dave, welcome back, I should say, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks very much. I had a great time the first time.
Yeah, well, that's why we brought you back for part two. Also, because WrestleMania is coming up in less than 2 weeks, as we tape this. So there's going to be a lot of interest in this podcast from certainly the people who listen to my podcast who are wrestling fans, as well as just wrestling fans in general. So it's a great time. I'm going to try my best not to cover a lot of the stuff we covered on the first podcast. You can go back if you haven't listened to that. It's in the 70s, and we're now in the 110s or so. So it's about 40 podcasts back. But one thing, Dave, I did not ask you that I should have on the first podcast, and that is specific. We're gonna keep this specific to wrestling as opposed to MMA. But what have you found that your readers are most interested in? Are they most interested in WWE, or does it really go across the board from the independent shows to New Japan and to WWE?
That's hard. I mean, realistically, it's WWE by leaps and bounds. I mean, WWE carries it. The hardcore fans are interested in everything, and there's fans that really follow like the independent scene and the foreign scene, and I try to follow it because it's all part of the business. But I mean, you know, every aspect, it's really a WWE dominated business. I mean, especially in this country, even like in places like, you know, Japan and Mexico actually have home promotions that are more popular than WWE in their country, but those, you know, those companies have, New Japan has a little bit of interest in the United States now because it's on Access and because it's kind of got a good buzz. And a lot of, I mean, it's good enough to where a star that goes directly from New Japan, like Shinsuke Nakamura or AJ Styles, walk into WWE and get like a fantastic reaction and are very well known. So there's a knowledge, there's clearly a knowledge of those products among a lot of American fans. But still, when it comes to interest level, you know, there's no comparison.
Dave, when we first talked, it was fairly new in the Raw and SmackDown split as two separate entities, separate shows, separate quote-unquote brands. Now that we are in March, and we're taping this on March 21st, how would you evaluate so far the success or lack of success between the split of Raw and SmackDown?
I would have to call it a pretty big success because, I mean, I don't think the Raw ratings aren't, are, you know, have, are on a downslide, you know, as with a lot of sports on television, obviously, although more than most sports. But they haven't gotten, you know, I mean, I think that they've fallen at the same level they were going to fall either way. It's not like the numbers now are, I mean, they're lower than they were a year ago, but they were going to be anyway. SmackDown's numbers, on the other hand, are the same, if not higher, than they were a year ago, which goes against the grain. And from a live attendance standpoint, the SmackDown shows have done, since John Cena returned, have done really well. The Monday Raws are, as far as attendance goes, are a little bit down. The SmackDown are significantly up. So, I mean, it's been a balance. I mean, the key is that SmackDown, when they didn't have John Cena around, it was tough. But when John Cena returned, John Cena is the only real big difference maker in the company. And in the last couple months, he came back. He was doing some TV projects. So he's been back since Christmas, and he's going to leave after WrestleMania. But as soon as he came back, the attendance at the SmackDown shows went up, and the TV ratings are higher. So, I mean, you can really see his impact on everything. But it's also given a lot more people opportunities for television and to shine. So they have more, you know, more people in better positions. So, I mean, to me as a fan, I find it SmackDown's a much better show now. It's more, you know, before it was kind of like SmackDown got the Raw cast off stuff, and now SmackDown's its own entity and a good show, and most weeks better than Raw. So, yeah, overall, I would have to call it a plus.
Actually, one thing on that, Dave, now that I think about it, in terms of, are you surprised that we haven't seen more crossover at all where someone goes from SmackDown to Raw in a trade, or they occasionally throw us a storyline that crosses over into both shows?
You know, I mean, the first time they did that a lot, and this time, you know, it seems like there's really been a thing where they're really trying to keep them separate. I think that's what will happen. More than doing mixed shows, I mean, the only mixed stuff that I can really recall is, like, they sent Brock Lesnar and Kevin Owens to Madison Square Garden for a house show because, you know, it's Madison Square Garden to spruce up the show. But aside from that, there's been almost nothing like that where someone, you know, occasionally, I mean, there was run-ins before, I believe it was Survivor Series, to build up a mixed match. You know, Randy Orton was on one show, Lesnar was on the other. When Randy Orton and Lesnar had their match, since they were on separate brands, so there was that one match that was like that. But yeah, for the most part, they've kept them far more apart than they did the first time. I expect after WrestleMania that they'll do a draft or something like that, and if they do, then I think some key guys will go back and forth, so you have fresher matchups. But except for stuff involving Lesnar, really, there's one of the Survivor Series matches, there hasn't been a lot of it. Yeah,
Dave, when we spoke last time, ESPN had sort of, they'd really gone in terms of wrestling coverage, dedicating parts of their or a part of their site to covering certainly the WWE on almost, if it's not a daily basis, it's fairly close. We know the connection with SportsCenter and WWE. In fact, as we tape this today, I believe Triple H is in Bristol.
Yeah, he's doing a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, doing the car wash. One of the things that you were looking to when that came down was how journalistically sound ESPN was going to be. You had no doubt that they would do the features and they would profile and get some pretty good access to the talent. But what you were not sure was, would they ever do a negative story on the WWE? And for my sort of following this, admittedly not close on a day-to-day basis, but as a general rule and certainly watching on TV, I haven't seen much of that. It's fairly speaking from pretty positive coverage, certainly fun, but they haven't gone to the underbelly of the sports entertainment business. What have you seen so far in terms of ESPN's coverage of professional wrestling, in particular the WWE?
Well, I think what it is they consider WWE as this lighthearted entertainment that's not worthy of real journalistic coverage, but it gets them hits. And they have a relationship with them, and so I think that they cover it accordingly. I mean, I didn't expect them to do any hard-hitting stuff. They haven't done any hard-hitting stuff. There have been controversial things that they haven't touched. And so that's, you know, and you know, on the TV version, you know, the TV version is total fluff. I mean, there's, like, stories, you know, like, let's say, you know, if a major star passed away or something like that that wasn't That was a well-known name in parts of the country. I mean, it's not like, you know, and that's not even a negative. That's just a story. You know, they don't really cover it unless it's, you know, it almost feels like it's WWE Puff Piece for the week. And, you know, and that's all they're going to talk about on the TV version. And, you know, like the Snuka stuff, you know, which actually was a pretty major news story that made a lot of places. Obviously, on the SportsCenter, you know, they did mention his death as far as the thing, but they didn't delve into the story of Jimmy Snuka. I had to write two major stories on it for two straight weeks because there's so much to it. He was such a huge figure in the business, and then there was the death in 1983 of Nancy Argentino, which was one of the more fascinating, you know, homicide cases that I've ever seen because, you know, nothing was really done when it happened, and then 30 years later it came back as a major news story. And, you know, they didn't, you know, when Snuka died, it was a chance to really see what they would do and how they would, you know, how much they would go into it. And there was some stuff on the website, but not much, you know, and not really going into the great detail. And on the TV, they didn't touch it at all. I mean, as far as the news story aspect, they did mention the Snuka death.
Do you think, that's interesting, do you think it, you think it's a net positive for them in terms of the association, Dave, in that...
For WWE?
No, a net positive for ESPN in that they would like to get the audience that the W... You know, it's...
If you're looking at it as an entertainment business, WWE has a lot of fans. Pro wrestling has a lot of fans. So, yeah, it's more popular than a lot of sports that they cover. So it's something worth coverage, even though it's not a true sport. You know, I think everybody that's in the last couple of years has started to get into it. You know, for years it was considered beneath sports people to touch wrestling, and I think that, you know, there were enough wrestling fans that and enough interest that it probably should have been done, but you know. Now that boundary is down, everybody tries to cover it because they know that it means hits and things like that. And so I don't, you know, I get that. But my thought always was, is if you're going to cover it, you know, cover it like you would cover, you know, football, or you're going to cover everything. You know, if you're going to give it real journalists, if you're going to put it in a real journal, in a real news fashion or journalism fashion, then cover it as journalism. Don't cover it as just some kind of fluff entertainment.
And right.
That's what a lot of people do.
Although I think if we're going to be honest, would the WWE, if ESPN, let's say, started doing that, you would see a significant change in the access that the WWE is allowing ESPN to have.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, but isn't that part of all sports?
Well, yeah, it is, although I guess in some situations there are leagues that understand that the almost good and the bad and the negative are going to be part of the coverage, and that they...
Shouldn't WWE be just the same? I mean, one of the things...
As someone who loves the WWE, I absolutely agree they should be. They're a company that's big, that's public, and they have to, like any other sports entity, realize that there's good and bad with that.
Yeah, I mean, I know from my perspective, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I have open communication with them, you know, all the time, so it's not a negative. But is it, you know, if I compare the amount of you know, access I would have on an official basis to UFC, which I cover very closely, and you know, you write negative and positive about UFC, and UFC sometimes gets a rep from some people as like, oh, you know, if you write something negative, they deny you access. And there's been things with UFC, you know, obviously, you know, that have happened that were pretty ugly, like the thing with Ariel Helwani, and he's not the only one, with some of the reporters. Yet, even so, you know, I've never felt any, I mean, you still get a lot more access if you write negative stuff about them, as compared to, say, a WWE, where, you know, it's a weird, tenuous thing, and yeah, I don't know. You can go, like, ESPN's big enough, and if they really wanted to do it, would WWE shut them out for some negative stories? But, you know, honestly, the answer is no, unless they really... I think that WWE, if put in that position, I mean, they wouldn't be happy, but no one's happy with the negative stories. But I think that, for whatever reason, a lot of entities really just don't want to go into depth on WWE business or pro wrestling business, for that matter.
Dave, last time we talked, you told me you started The Observer in 1983. You've been writing pro wrestling since 1971. Do you enjoy the content today as much as you did, let's say, when, you know, you were in your 20s and the 70s or 80s, et cetera?
I think about the same, maybe a little more now. It's
why is
that? The style of wrestling, I mean, the quantity's rough. I mean, there's so much to digest as compared to the past because, you know, because of the internet. It's a wonderful tool. But the I think that the style of wrestling and the wrestlers of today, because the mentality of the wrestlers is very different. You know, now everybody is, you know, there's an art form to pro wrestling, and everyone knows, and everyone's trying their best and striving for their best. Before, a lot of it was just like, how do we make the most money possible while injuring ourselves the least? Or, you know, there was the mentality that the fans were stupid and everything like that, and so, you know, we're just putting on, you know, fake fights and fooling the fans. And now everyone knows what it is, and there's a certain, the guys work so hard now, and the guys are so physically talented now. I mean, the stuff, you know, I just was at a show on Saturday, and it was just blew my mind how good the show was. And like, say, 20 years ago, there would be, you know, some good, there's always been great matches, but, you know, there's so many more now. I mean, I think that the quality of the actual in-ring is, some people will say it's worse. I think it's generally, especially from a WWE standpoint, WWE, I think, they're not the best in the ring at all, but WWE, as far as consistent, if you go to a live WWE show now, you will get a better show than you would have gotten certainly in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, just even though there were great guys in the 80s and the 90s, you know, the quality up and down is better now. And yeah, so overall, I think I like it more. Yeah.
Dave, one of the things that really stood out with me last time was you told me that wrestlers contact you daily. And what I didn't follow up with, and I wish I did, was are we talking about names that the public would know? Is it kind of dialogue?
What? I mean, I've been around for, you know, doing this for 30 years. I pretty much, I don't say I know everybody because there are exceptions, but, you know, I could contact most people, I think.
And
yeah.
and then this, obviously the
I mean, I contact a lot of them too, you know, but I mean, I mean, that's kind of how I get most of my information is from people in the industry.
So then the follow-up question, if I didn't ask it, I'll certainly ask it now, is can you characterize how today's wrestlers are in terms of talking about the business, the sport, giving you information versus, let's say, in the 80s or 90s? Today's wrestler more forthcoming or today's wrestler more, you know, sort of protective of what's going on within their circles?
That really varies. The wrestlers that I talked to in the 80s and 90s, I think were more forthcoming just because it was kind of like, if you talk to me, yes, it'll get in the newsletter, but it's not like it's going to be general news. So people will, you know, like a lot of people would be like, yeah, you know, put it in the newsletter. The super hardcore fans are going to know about it. No one else is going to know about it. It's cool. And now I think the realization is that anything I write will, you know, if it's real big news, will be everywhere. So I would say that I have access to more people. But yes, I mean, on certain stories, they're going to be more guarded because they know, you know, before it was like, yeah, only a few people are going to know. So it's not that big of a deal. And you know, they kind of want their news out. Now it's kind of like, oh God, if the news gets out, you know what I mean? Will it ruin the storyline? Will, you know, I mean, everybody will start talking about it. Like if I talk about like the main event at next year's WrestleMania, which I actually already reported, you know, if it was a couple of years ago, yeah, super hardcore fans would know about it ahead of time before this WrestleMania. But, yeah, you know, I mean, the day I reported, it was like everywhere. The next day, oh, my God, this is what they're planning for next year's WrestleMania. And so it's a different – it's just changed. The internet's changed everything, you know, in social media.
Let's talk about this year's current WrestleMania, which if I'm correct about this, I'm not sure, honestly, Dave, when you reported or wrote this, but you have basically sort of put out what you believe is going to be the full card or the full card of the main matches, correct?
Now because we're only a couple weeks away as we're taping this, pretty much the whole card is out, but I had probably, you know, a couple months ago reported the key matches,
right?
You know, and you know, before January, anyway, I mean, before the Royal Rumble, I pretty much had, you know, the top key matches as they changed and things like that. I mean, there were a few changes here and there, as always will be. But I guess when I look now, you know, Undertaker Reigns, you know, which was a changed match. But Goldberg Lesnar, I think I probably reported in November, and Wyatt and Orton, you know, well before it happened.
When did you, so, you know, is Triple H Rollins relatively new, or was that something you had a while ago?
No. That I probably knew that one from day one as well. I mean, and that's not a secret, because if you watch the TV, there was a show, I mean, months ago, where just out of the blue, out of nowhere, Seth Rollins just goes, you know, I want Triple H. So it's like, if you even have knowledge of how wrestling works, I didn't have to have inside knowledge to know that match was planned for WrestleMania, because it was planned for last year's WrestleMania, but Rollins hurt his knee
right,
and missed WrestleMania. So as soon as he cut that promo, it was like, you know, it was completely out of context with what they were doing. It's like, oh, okay, that's the first tease for WrestleMania, and that was months ago. So yeah, that's you know, likely been on the books, you know, if it's not months, for a year.
So I want to ask you a couple questions about these matches, and not how you think they will go or whether they'll be good, but I'm sort of interested in how the company looks in terms of the storytelling heading forward. So one of the things that you've written about a lot is how the WWE has wanted Roman Reigns to sort of be the face of the company at a certain point, you know, beating Cena to sort of, like, I guess, signal the end of one era to the beginning of another era. So when we look at some of these matches, particularly, I want to focus on three of them: Undertaker Reigns, Goldberg Lesnar, and Triple H Rollins. And you could take each one individually, but what in your opinion is sort of the reasoning behind those three matches heading forward into 2017 and 2018?
Well, Undertaker Reigns, obviously, in a sense, you know, Reigns, as far as a full-time day-to-day basis, is their chosen star. And it's been a real tough one. I don't think they've ever had a situation where their chosen star was so vehemently rejected by at least the vocal audience. They will argue that the real audience, the masses, love him. It's hard to say, because sometimes you go to arenas and he's very, very popular, and sometimes you go to arenas and he's not. And on TV and pay-per-view, he's almost always booed.
Right.
But that's not necessarily, you know, and they'll argue, like, look at John Cena. You know, it's like, who is a big, you know, revenue driver and everything like that. And it's like, and is the best guy for that position that he's been in, but as a babyface got booed a hell of a lot. And just say, like, that's what's going to happen to a top babyface now, is that a lot of the fans are going to boo them, and that's just part of it. And there's something to that. At the same time, with the amount of push that Roman Reigns has gotten, he should be bigger than he is. But when you're going, like, well, who should be the guy, then it becomes tougher, because, you know, I thought, you know, me, when it was pretty clear that the Shield were the guys that they were grooming, which is Dean Ambrose, Roman Reigns, and Seth Rollins, to be the keys in the company going forward, I thought, you know, that originally everybody figured that Roman Reigns would be, like, the top babyface. He would be the company choice, because it was obvious for years he was going to be the company choice the way it was projected. But Roman Reigns was weak on interviews, and interviews are really important. I think the feeling was that Dean Ambrose was going to be a heel and Seth Rollins a babyface. And the question was, could Seth Rollins be a big enough babyface? And they ended up going heel with Seth Rollins. Dean Ambrose was an effective babyface, but whenever he kind of got momentum, they cut his legs off. And I was thinking that, like, well, Dean Ambrose is a lot better talker than Roman Reigns, and I just thought that people could relate to him more, and I thought that maybe he should be the guy. But then they beat him down so much to where he really, I think he's been put at a certain point where he really can't be the guy. So now you've got a situation where do you wait for a new guy, or do you choose someone else? And there's nobody else that's really, like, you look at it and just go, like, this guy is just, like Daniel Bryan when he came through, or even Punk to an extent, where you go, these guys are just breaking through, you know, and you've got to go with them. There's really not that guy now, so it's kind of a muddled situation. So, you know, the idea is Roman Reigns. So Roman Reigns and Undertaker, depending on as far as who wins and loses, I don't know who's going to win and lose, and there's arguments, but if Roman Reigns loses, it's the start of a storyline of a redemption and a comeback.
Right.
And if he wins, it's going to be tough, because the people are going to boo him like crazy. They'll resent him for beating Undertaker. And unless the idea is to turn him heel for a while and then turn him back babyface, which really worked well for one of the Japanese stars, Tetsuya Naito, as an example, who's now the hottest wrestler in Japan. There's just like so many. It's intriguing. There's so many different ways that you can go with that. But the ultimate goal is Roman Reigns top babyface and face of the company in the 2018 WrestleMania. Yes.
Well, it's interesting because I can't see given that I can't see Reigns winning for the exact reason that you pointed out is because I think the fans then you get the fans upset for him beating Undertaker, and you could still get him to be sort of the face of your company without that.
He doesn't need to win.
He doesn't need to win, right? I agree. Right. I agree with it. You know, someone actually who follows wrestling, who's a friend of mine, wanted me to ask you when I told him you were on the podcast. Do you have any sense, Dave, as to how long The Undertaker can go in terms of just, at least in terms of the eye test, he looks like he's in great shape, physically looks good, moves around the ring pretty good, but...
He just had hip surgery. He's beaten down real bad. Put it this way, last year when he went to the dressing room after his match, he told everyone he was done.
Wow.
And he skipped the European tour. And, I mean, that's not the first time. This is funny, because the first time I was told about Undertaker, I just remember I was having dinner with one of the top WWE wrestlers in 97, and he just goes, man, you know, Mark's so beat up. I don't think he can go more than another year or two. This is 20 years ago now. So, I mean, he does only do one or a few matches a year, so that's easier on him. He has time to heal, but you know his hips are shot and he's got a lot of injuries, and there's many different years I've been told that he's done where they believe he's done, and he comes back every year, so I don't know. It's only one match, so again, like last year when WrestleMania was over, I mean he told them, you know, I'm done, and that was it, and now here we are. You know, he had the surgeries and everything like that, and he's back.
All right, let's go around for a couple of different topics. I think you wrote about this over the last week or so, and that's the breach that the wrestler Paige suffered when someone hacked into her, I don't know if it was her phone or her iCloud account, and sent out videos and photos, explicit videos and photos of her, and Xavier Woods and another wrestler, I forgot his name, Brad
Maddox.
Right. This is always an interesting, and certainly we feel horrible for Paige. It's total BS that someone does that to you. But the WWE, Dave, as you know, is it's a public company. They're always sort of, I think, protecting against any kind of scandal. And she was already, I think, was she on suspension or some kind of discipline at this point?
She had been on, I mean, her suspension's actually over, but she'd been on two different suspensions in probably the last year, for wellness policy failures, drug test failures.
So what do they do now with the fact that this is a breach? It's not her fault at all. It's sexual in nature, obviously. And they also have at least one of the wrestlers who's active in the company involved in this. If it were me, I wouldn't do anything. I would just, if they're going to bring her back, they bring her back. But I'm sure they are worried, and I guess understandably so, about the crowd chanting stuff if she walks out and stuff. How do you envision the WWE handling this one, which is not the easy situation to handle?
Yeah, it's not an easy one. I mean, my sense of everything that's gone down and in some contact with them on it is that they are not going to do anything. And that's probably, you know, when I really think it out, it's the right thing.
Yeah, you can't victim shame. That would be the wrong thing.
Yeah, she's the victim. Nobody, I mean, and then also this was stuff that was from, I don't know how many years ago, but it was probably 4 years ago, roughly. So it's, and plus you set a precedent. Let's just say in this day of social media, anyone who has, a breakup, the other person can put stuff out there on the internet and can cost them their job. You know what I mean? It's like that's just a terrible precedent to set. Plus, they're doing a movie on Paige, WWE and $7 Promotion or Entertainment, which is Dwayne Johnson's company. They were already filmed scenes. They filmed a lot of the movie already. So, there's just so much in her being with the company. And again, if they did anything to her, you would have to do it to Woods, who's a popular character, and you'd be up for situations going forward, because this, there's other women this may happen to, and it's not their, I mean, you know, you can argue maybe they should be more protective or maybe they shouldn't have shot it, but geez, that's, you know, again, this is something from, in all these cases, these are things from a long time
back.
Yeah,
it's also moral. It's, who are we to moralize anyway? People should be able to do what they want in their own homes. Right, exactly. That's all right. Well, I appreciate you answering that. It's interesting. We'll see how that goes. The one of the things you told me last time was that the WWE is absolutely active in scouting Olympians and college.
Yeah, they had the guys at the NCAAs on Saturday.
Which is going to say college wrestlers. You thought they should be scouting Olympic gymnasts, which was really interesting. I thought, what's the update on that? Is that an active 365 day thing where they're always looking for talent in these in these places?
Yeah, they have a couple of people. Canyon Seaman, you know, runs around scouting different sports. Gerald Briscoe's really a guy who's heavily scouts the amateur wrestling scene. He's at all the big meets and everything. You know, and of course, and all the guys, you know, William Regal's super, super strong on scouting the independent scene, which is really where most of the talent's going to come from, because those are people who have an affinity for wrestling. And, like, there are certain places like, you know, PWG and some of the other companies that are some of these independent shows that are, I don't want to say they're under the radar, but they're like cult places where the wrestlers know, the best wrestlers end up getting picked to go there. And the wrestlers know, hey, there's people from WWE here, and even if not, the word's going to get around. If I'm on this show and I have a great match, it's going to get a buzz to my name, and that's where a lot of guys' names come from. And WWE, you know, they're, anyone who's really good that's out there, WWE is in contact with in some form. I know people sometimes will go, does WWE need, you know, about, like, Matt Riddle, who's a former UFC fighter, who's one of the best guys on the indie scene right now. And people go, like, I think WWE knows about him, because I know WWE knew about him before he even had his first match. They knew about him when he was training at the Monster Factory. And, you know, they're involved. They were involved in his career path. Now, they haven't signed him yet, but, you know, they know who he is. I mean, they know who... If they're good and I know who they are and I try to follow everything as much as I can, they do too.
Dave, how do you, you know, one of the things that is great when you're watching this stuff is you really, an announcer can make, is an absolute difference maker, both in the enjoyment of the product as well as getting people over. It's one of the reasons I love Bobby Heenan, whether it was a WCW or WWE. He was just phenomenal to listen to. Funny,
incredible timing.
Yeah, I mean, the greatest heel broadcaster in the history of pro wrestling. In terms of today's broadcasters, and let's just sort of focus on Raw for the second. How would you rate Michael Cole, Saxton, and Graves, both as a team and as sort of individual broadcasters heading forward?
You know, most of the reaction to Cole is that he's kind of there and he does what he does, and it's just the role. And, you know, I enjoyed Jim Ross more. I thought that he got matches over better. I thought he got personalities and talent over better. But Michael Cole does the job. He's very good at the job that he's supposed to do, and it's a tough job. And when he was left to his own devices on a UK broadcast a couple months ago, he was actually quite good. Saxton is there. I mean, I don't find anything particularly good or bad about him, and he's not in a role where he can really be good or bad. And I think Graves is very quick-witted, and I'm actually quite a big fan of his. I like his delivery, and he thinks well on his feet, and he's allowed to be, you know, he's probably in a position where he's allowed to be really good too. But when he and you know, Mauro Ranallo do the 205 Live on Tuesday nights after SmackDown on the WWE Network, to me, that's my favorite announcing duo announcing team in WWE right now.
Is Ranallo, you think, the long term successor to Cole on the big WWE pay per view style stuff, WrestleMania, or is that person maybe not in the company yet?
I don't really know. Cole's not that old, and I don't think Cole's more than a couple years older than Ranallo.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know that. I think that they're going to have two faces of the company, because, like, on WrestleMania, my presumption would be that Ranallo and the SmackDown team does the SmackDown matches, and Cole and Graves and Byron Saxton do the Raw matches, and probably Ranallo and Graves do the Cruiserweight matches. So I think that it'll be so I don't think there'll be like one specific guy like Cole has been. I think that they'll both be the guy. And if someone's coming up, you know, whether it's Tom Phillips, who they've been using on SmackDown a lot, where I kind of get the sense they want to use him more, I don't know. But the announcers come and go there, so you never really know. And they have a job that they want the announcers to do. I think that the announcers can be better in a lot of ways. I mean, I will say that I enjoyed Mauro Ranallo more when he was doing the access stuff from New Japan. Not that I don't enjoy him on SmackDown, and I really enjoyed Ranallo and Daniel Bryan on 205 Live and, or on the Cruiserweight Classic. That was really probably the best announcing. But they also had great, great matches, which helped them out. And that's probably why I liked, that show more than the 205 Live, is probably just the match quality isn't nearly as good, even though, in reality, I mean, Corey Graves and Ranallo make a good team.
How do you view the use of women in broadcasting for the WWE, whether it's sort of been the Renee Young role? You would know this more than me, but has a woman ever had the Raw analyst position? Have they ever put a woman in that sort of main chair, or are they always sort of in the, for lack of a better phrase, the sideline reporting position?
Yeah, they used the interviewer. They've used the interviewer for probably 20 years or close to that. And most haven't been good. Renee Young is really good. She's the exception. I mean, it's like they hire pretty women, a lot of them just they can be very wooden. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. And you kind of go like, I guess they're just, they're just there for the look and everything. NXT, they did give Renee Young some she was like the third analyst for a time on NXT. And my impression was they were, because that's what NXT's for, that they were preparing her for one of the main shows, but it hasn't happened yet. And she was different and she was fine in the role. It wasn't like she was battered or anything like that, but they just haven't given her the spot. And she's, like I said, just personality-wise and getting over with the audience and everything like that, she's been a big hit there.
All right, a couple more before we get to the audience questions. Dave, what do you remember about working at the National? And did you feel this long ago, phenomenal daily paper that was a daily sports paper that was way ahead of its time? Did you feel revolutionary in the fact that the National, which was, for lack of a better phrase, the ESPN.com of its day in print? Did you feel revolutionary in that no one had made wrestling that mainstream until Frank DeFord came to you and said, "We want you to do a wrestling column"?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think at the time. It was kind of like it happened so quick, and it was such a short period of time, and I was working so hard that I never really. It was just something that I did, and I thought it was really cool that, I was not the first guy to do a wrestling column, because some of the newspapers had done them, but this was on a national one, and it had readership in New York, which the other ones didn't have, it wasn't like when I had heard about the National, I never thought that they would. I mean, it wasn't like I'm going like I sent in a resume and go, hey, or even contact Frank DeFord and go, hey, you should cover pro wrestling, and maybe I should have. Somehow through different means, he decided that he wanted to cover pro wrestling, and he asked a couple of people who he knew were wrestling fans, and they all, pretty much recommended me. So that's kind of how that happened. And I thought that it was like kind of after a couple months, I felt it was, kind of getting your sea legs down and learning to write for that type of style, because I'd written a completely different style for years. I was really enjoying it, and then it went away.
I read the National, although, quite frankly, Dave, I don't remember your column, no offense, as much as I respect your work. Was it a weekly or bi-weekly?
It was weekly. I think it was usually every Tuesday.
What was it like? Did you profile somebody, or did you do kind of like a notes column where you sort of would just go around the horn on different stuff?
Both. I mean, it's usually like a main story and then maybe some notes, on some news items that had taken place over the past week.
Wow. That I will say, on a national level, that is way ahead of its time.
The whole newspaper was ahead of its time. It's like, when I look back now, I kind of think, like, between that and also when I did IATA, which was like, essentially podcasting or internet radio, it was like, I was in like these two places, especially IATA, that really could have taken off. But they were just like a couple, in both cases, I think they were just not, the timing wasn't right. The product was right.
Exactly.
The product would have, and it kind of like is like, man, I was almost there twice. You know what I mean?
If DeFord had started this thing in, I'm just making this up, 1997, where, you know, Google and these Silicon Valley places are starting up, the web is starting to sort of grow, and the distribution exists, because that's what's killed the National. You just couldn't distribute.
They didn't have the right distribution.
Game changer, because it would have literally been like reading the New Yorker of sports on a daily basis, and that business would have been successful, and who knows what they would have become. So
They could have become. I mean, like, especially with his affinity for hiring the best reporters.
Exactly.
They could have been the go-to sports site. You know, starting as a newspaper, but ending up as the go-to sports site. Yeah, I thought about that from time to time.
I think if I had to, and again, this is all pie in the sky, I think someone would have eventually bought them. Is what would have happened is some big place would have made them their sports entity, and the National would be like a brand, the way we think of ESPN or NBC Sports or something like that. There's just so much talent there. We touched on this, Dave, a little bit, but this has sort of now become interesting to me. When I talked to you about the explosion of wrestling podcasts, you in the last 24 months, you had told me the last time where you said wrestling had been so undercovered for such a long time that it was not surprising now that it was sort of we got this explosion of podcasts and that there might even be over coverage. I want to ask you specifically, though, about Conrad Thompson's podcasts, which one is very popular with Bruce Pritchard, Something to Wrestle With, and then there's one, What Happened When, with Tony Schiavone. Conrad Thompson was on this podcast not too long ago, and we had a long discussion about sort of how he started. I think what he's done has been unbelievable. I really like Something to Wrestle With. You, Dave, as you know, have become you're a figure on that podcast. Because Conrad relies so much on your newsletter, and so often there's a discussion between Conrad and Bruce Pritchard about something you wrote or said, and inevitably Bruce Pritchard will not be happy with you and say, fuck Dave Meltzer, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a number of questions on all of this stuff. First off, have you actively listened to Conrad's podcast with Bruce and Schiavone?
I haven't listened to one with Schiavone, and I've probably only listened to maybe two with Bruce. But I do hear about it from time to time, and usually it's people on the internet who, I mean, will try to stir stuff up.
Right.
In a lot of cases where, you know, people go, oh, Conrad said this and this and this about you, and I always would go, like, I don't believe he said that, because I actually don't know Conrad personally.
Yeah, it's usually, to be very blunt, having listened to most of them, it's usually Bruce Pritchard who has an issue with either something you report, not always, by the way, who has an issue with either something you reported, maybe like a ranking you gave a match, but it's usually comes to something.
Whatever. Stars, that's so opinionated.
Yeah, but it's usually more about here's what you reported, and then it's Bruce Pritchard's recollection, which is different. Now, I'm not saying that Bruce is right. That's where the discrepancy comes in.
Well, it depends on the situation. I mean, he sees it from one side, and I may get the same story from, you know, different sides and things like that. But I mean, as far as like, The ones that have come to my attention are basic facts and numbers, in which case when he poo-poos them, in every case, you know, I was correct. In every case. I mean, so because I'm pretty vigilant when it comes to the economics of wrestling. You know, when it comes to an opinion, it's something. When it comes to reporting of a news story, you know, he's going to have his perspective on how he views it and everything like that. I don't have any real animosity towards Bruce.
Do you have a sense as to why he may have animosity towards you?
I don't know. You know, I mean, everyone in wrestling that was in a power position probably does, just because of the nature of what I did.
Right,
I mean,
being
critical of management when they make mistakes, and sometimes I'm wrong too.
Right,
but you know, I mean, I have a pretty good track record historically.
Yeah,
but you know, when he started, I mean, I don't know how it would have evolved, because maybe it would have ended up this way anyway. But I mean, the way it started was kind of like a silly thing, because he did. The first one where I guess was after he did a show very early on the 1997 Survivor Series, which was probably one of the three or four most famous matches because of the controversy behind it with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, where Bret Hart essentially got double crossed on the finish. He was supposed to win by disqualification, but they called the match in the middle and they had Bret lose the WWF Championship at the time. And there was a movie that was made on it.
Of course.
Brett screwed Brett,
one of the most famous
lines
in history.
And Bruce obviously is going to have a certain take because he was on the Vince McMahon side of what happened. And I had a take from talking to everyone, including Bruce at the time. Me and him talked, you know, pretty extensively. I think it was The show was on a Sunday, so I think it was on a Monday. It might have been a Tuesday, right after, with his side, and he told me his side and the company's side, and he wasn't the only one from the company by any chance. You know, they all told me their side, and then Brett told me his side, and I kind of worked out a story on it, and you know, I have my own opinions of it, and he did a podcast, and he gave his opinions of it, which were well and good, but there's like two or three key points, and I didn't listen to it, which was, you know, whatever, but one of my best friends just goes like, you know, whatever you do, don't listen to Bruce's podcast about Montreal. I go, okay, I won't. And then he just goes, and then I just said that, like, well, did he cover, you know, I kind of asked three questions. I go, like, he can say whatever he wants. It's his, I know what framework he's going to come from, because, you know, he told me his framework literally the day after it happened. So I go, like, did he bring up, and there were three points that I brought up, and he goes, he brought up none of the three. And then people were just asking me about it. I go, like, look, you can't do that story without bringing up the three points, one of which was that Bret Hart had creative control in his contract at that point in time, which changed the dynamic of the decision-making process. You can't bring it up without mentioning that Bret and Vince came to an agreement on the result of the match the Wednesday before, and Shawn Michaels, which was Bret would win, and then Shawn Michaels would beat Bret in a rematch, because Bret would lose to Shawn Michaels if Shawn lost the first one, and Shawn turned that down, which changed the dynamic of everything. And I think there was one other one that wasn't his last match, that, you know, he was still under contract to the company for another 3 weeks, so they could have beat, you know, he could have lost to other people. And I've seen the letters from his lawyer to Vince, and, I mean, they very specifically said that he's willing to lose to this person on this date, and as long as it wasn't in Montreal on that date. And it wasn't like he was refusing to lose the championship and then going to another company. Because if he was doing that, if that was his idea, I would not be in any way supportive of Bret Hart, and I would understand what Vince did. But that wasn't really the case. It's the case that people portray it, and there's also the case where people claim, with no foundation whatsoever, that he was going to go directly from Montreal to WCW television the next day with the WWE belt, so Vince had no choice into what he would do. And that was actually an excuse that went through the WWE company, which was a complete lie, because, number one, he was still under contract. There was lawsuits out. There was no way he could appear on Nitro. There's no way he could bring the WWE belt to Nitro because of the intellectual property. That had already been established in a court case with Vince, and when Ric Flair brought the old NWA belt onto WWE television. So, and there was a lawsuit about them using the WWF Women's Championship when Medusa threw it in the garbage can, and there was a lawsuit out at the time over that. So much of that, you know, it's like you have to, if you're going to do the story, you've got to at least do those 3 points, and he didn't do it. So I go, like, you know, you can't do the story without those 3 points. And from there, that was kind of when Bruce was just, like, going after me all the time. So all right, that's where that came from.
I appreciate your background. And listen, your point is correct about if you're inevitably there's going to be conflicts with reporters and people in power. We see it in Washington. You know, Sean Spicer is not going to like Glenn Thrush, nor is Donald Trump. And that's just sort of how the game is. One last thing on this podcast, Dave. The numbers that Conrad has for these podcasts are really phenomenal. At least at the start. Do you have any sense? I mean, listen, we've seen other popular podcasts, the Cheap Heat stuff, and Shoemaker's done really good work, and obviously Jericho and Steve Austin. There are some...
Austin had some really big numbers.
Yeah, but there's something... They've hit on something. I think it's terrific. Do you have any sense as to why you think this one has really clicked in a way that maybe even the top podcasts haven't clicked?
It's inside knowledge of WWE history from the WWE standpoint. And, you know, a lot of that stuff, again, most people, I mean, I wrote about it, all that stuff at the time, but I was like, and I wasn't the only one who did it, but I was one of the few, but it didn't have, you know, again, didn't have that kind of an audience.
Right.
So it's like, you know, there's a whole generation of people who grew up, you know, with, whether it's the Survivor Series in 1997 or, you know, whatever it is, different controversial things, you know, the changing of the championships or why did this thing happen? And, you know, I mean, you know, I know a lot about it, and a lot of our readers, you know, my readers know about it, but to the public, you know, I mean, this is all new information, and it really is, and it is inside information. I mean, it's like, so I think that, you know, unlike with, you know, because he was in there with in the decision-making process, where the wrestlers know from a wrestler standpoint a lot of the stuff, but yeah, he's got access to a lot of the stuff, you know, a lot of the decision-making process that was going on at the time, so I think that that's probably... a big part of it. And also, I think his memory's probably pretty good.
Yeah.
A lot of people in wrestling, I mean, the reality is their memories are not that good, and they start saying stuff that you just go like, hey, wait a minute. You know, historically, this is just completely accurate. And sometimes Bruce does too, but his memory is better than most, and he's also a good communicator.
All right, here are the last couple before we get to audience questions. Can you give my listeners a sense of where you think the possibilities exist of both Hulk Hogan and CM Punk returning in any form to WWE?
I think Hogan's inevitable. Just a question of when. They're going to do. I mean, they don't want any backlash when they bring him back, and you know, those were pretty racial remarks and everything that he said. It was pretty bad. I think the fan base wants him back, but you know, even with me, like if I'm in that chair and it's like my call, it's like, man, I'd be a little nervous because let's just say somebody strong in the African American community, you bring him back and just goes, you just brought back this guy who said this. What's your explanation? And I'm going to sit there and go like, I was just hoping nobody would say anything. That's my explanation. So that's why, like, I'd be really nervous. And obviously they are, because if it wasn't, you know, he's a cultural icon and part of that big library that they got and one of the strongest figures they ever had. And they've been cautious about bringing him back. So it's going to be when they're comfortable with it, but I think it's inevitable. Punk comes down to Punk at the end of the day. Vince McMahon, as much as there's probably people, oh, he should never let him back. No matter who it is, and Bret Hart's, you know, example, Bruno Sammartino's an example, they're going to do what they think is right for business in most cases. I mean, there's always personal thing that's going to stand there, but if CM Punk tomorrow, you know, was to leave UFC and call them up and go, hey, you know, I'd like to come back, and I don't expect that to happen.
Right.
I think that they would say, yeah, we need stars, you're a star, it'll be huge for public interest. Come back. It's water under the bridge. We'll forget everything ever happened and all that. But the difference is Hulk Hogan wants to come back. CM Punk, as best I can tell, doesn't want to come back and may never want to come back. I mean, you know, you say time. The history says time heals all wounds, but this is going to be a tough one, and I don't know what CM Punk is going to do. I've never had an extensive conversation with him on it, but I do know his feelings from mutual friends pretty well. And I think that they're, you know, I don't know if he's thinking that today, but certainly like a year, you know, and of course, and there's a lawsuit involved in that that's kind of a contentious situation as well. But like, you know, a year ago, I think that he felt that if he ever went back, it would be like he lost the battle or he didn't, you know, and it's something he doesn't want to do. And he strongly doesn't want to go back. He doesn't want to be like Bret and Bruno and all those guys who eventually in the end went back, or Ultimate Warrior, who said they'd never go back and then did. He doesn't want to be that guy, but you know, if you look at history,
everybody's that guy. I want to believe he's the one guy who's not going to come back.
He may not,
but history basically says bet on coming back. That's just generally
right. But he is a unique person.
Agreed.
He's very different from all the other ones. I mean, in the sense of, you know, for him, I think that he's got, you know, and Bruno was the same way, you know, but you know, Bruno, they were, you know, it was water. It was decades later, and the person who recruited Bruno to come back, which was Triple H, Paul Levesque, you know, and Bruno had no animosity towards him whatsoever, and the business did change, you know, from what it was, and then just, you know, Bruno was older and things like that, and you know, but with Punk, you know, he does have animosity with those key people. And, you know, they did fire him on his wedding day. And granted, he'd already quit realistically first. But it's kind of like you still get that notice that you're fired, you know, right before you're about to get married on that same day.
Right.
And that's a tough one, you know what I mean, to just go, well, you know, it's all just business. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, you know, WWE will say that was just some weird coincidence that they're sorry for. And maybe they're telling the truth, but I don't know. Most people... People I know in wrestling, no one believes that coincidence could be anything, you know, could just be some weird coincidence.
Yeah, that's a hard one to get past.
Especially because he told Triple H a couple days earlier, oh, by the way, I'm getting married this weekend. So that's where the key comes in. And, you know, so, you know, I don't know what, you know, you would have to ask him what his opinion on it is. But, you know, I think that I don't expect him back anytime soon, put it that way.
All right, one more, and then we're getting to audience questions. What do you make of the possibilities, both for creative and commercial success for the Andre the Giant documentary that was announced by HBO?
I mean, it's a fascinating subject, and he's a really well-known guy. You know, it's funny because, you know, to me, growing up with Andre the Giant and everything, you know, you kind of think of that, you know, I mean, he passed away a long time ago, but it's 24 years. I mean, it's like, so I sometimes, like, when it comes to stuff like that, I guess because you get to a certain age, you don't really think that, man, that was a long time ago. There's a whole generation of people that never actually saw Andre the Giant except for maybe in the Princess Bride or old wrestling tapes, but never saw him in his, and certainly not in his heyday in the 70s, you know, because a lot of the footage of Andre was in the 80s when he was broken down and everything like that. But I think it could be a fascinating story. I know Bill Simmons wanted to do it for forever and ever. There's a story there. And, yeah, hopefully it's I mean, the subject is there. It's just it's a weird thing because when it was announced, one of my thoughts was like, you know, there's a lot of WWE history, mythology of Andre, and there's a lot of stories of Andre that are greatly, greatly embellished. And if you talk to old wrestlers, they're going, you know, wrestlers naturally embellish old stories and memories fade and things like that. So I was kind of like, man, I hope that they're really good at fact-checking because they're going to get a lot of BS, that you... I hope they don't go with, and I think that they know, and they know that. I know they know that actually. So I'm very intrigued by the finished product.
All right, let's get to some viewer questions, and then Dave will get you out of here. Thank you for your time. From Matt Johnson, does WWE brass take the same position regarding fans booing Roman Reigns as they do or did with John Cena?
Yeah, they like to think it's the exact same thing, and that's why that they're willing to ignore the idea of those boos, meaning that it's not working. The difference to me with John Cena and Roman Reigns was that, you know, I follow the business indicators, and John Cena did tremendous merchandise business and, you know, sold tickets and, you know, you could see he's a difference maker. So you just go in there and go like, all these people are booing him. They should turn him heel. And it's like, he's selling all this merchandise. Why would you turn him heel? Because that would affect his merchandise sales, and his merchandise sales are just gigantic. And obviously, people are paying money to boo him. And if they're paying money in the role, then don't change the role. It's working.
Right.
With Roman Reigns, I don't. There's not the same business indicators saying that. So that's the difference between the two of them. But he is still a big star, and their company is doing great. I mean, financially, they're doing just fine. So it's not like there's a motivation where they've got to make a change. It's just they just do whatever they, you know, they can really do what they want to. And yeah, I think that the fact that what happened with John Cena for 10 years, that when the same thing happens to Roman Reigns but not as strong, they can just go, hey, that's today's society. And they're not completely wrong, but with Daniel Bryan, as an example, when he was on top, nobody booed him. But, you know, he wasn't their pick.
From Frank Charney Jr., how healthy is independent wrestling in North America?
It's stronger than it's been in a long, long time, and it's like, and the internet has a lot to do with it, and streaming and everything like that. There are guys, there's a whole crew of independent guys, Jeff Cobb and Ricochet and Matt Riddle, who I just mentioned before, and you know, Will Ospreay from the UK and Marty Scurll from the UK, and some of the guys that are in Ring of Honor. I don't know if you consider Ring of Honor an indie or not, but you know, the Young Bucks are making like great livings.
Right.
They're you know, really pretty phenomenal what they've done with their business. I mean, being able to be like, to make legitimately great livings and not have to go to WWE. And a lot of these guys are making nice livings. I talked to like Zack Sabre, just for example, who's a UK wrestler, who's really great. And I remember, you know, I talked to him, you know, a couple weeks back, and he was just, you know, I got nothing against WWE, but I'm having fun with life. I don't got to go. You know, and I mean, it's not to say he won't go in a year or 2 years. I mean, if he wants to go, he can. He knows. He knows he's good enough to be there. But there's no, you know, he has no financial pressure to go anywhere. And a lot of those guys, like, I think most of them want to go somewhere at some point and want to be there at some point. And, you know, you cannot make $1 million a year on the independent scene no matter who you are. So if you want to make $1 million a year, you know, yeah, you do have to go to WWE, but, there's so many guys on the way up every couple of months, you hear a couple of new names and everything like that, and there's enough people who are into going to matches just to see great matches to where these shows can run, I guess, at a profitable basis because they're running it, you know, they're running shows all over the place. So, yes, it feels healthier than it's been in a long, long time.
Am I correct, Dave, that the Young Bucks named a move after you? Am I right about? Did I read that?
Yes, they did.
Nice. Is it called the Meltzer?
The Meltzer. Well, there's the Meltzer driver. There's the Shooting Star Meltzer driver, which Ricochet does with Matt Sydal, and there's the Best Meltzer Ever, which Christopher Daniels and Kazarian do. Those are the only ones that I know. But the Young Bucks were the ones that popularized doing that. And that, the funny story there is that they did that like on their own. I guess it was a marketing gimmick or whatever. I'm not sure exactly. You know, I've never actually spoken to them about the idea of it, but I actually did not even know them when they did it. Now, obviously, I know them now. But, you know, and I mean, it's just a funny story where people, oh, you know, like, you guys have been best friends for years. Like, I always wrote good stuff about them because they're phenomenal, but I did not know them until, you know, a lot later than anyone thinks.
From Mike Couture, when was the last time a wrestler called you to talk about a star rating you gave them, either negatively or thanking you for a big
rating.
Star
rating? You know, that's sort of considered bad form. I don't think that, I mean, I'm sure it must happen, but I couldn't even come up with it.
That's,
I mean, I don't even remember, like, I mean, fans debate it like crazy, but a wrestler calling about a star rating, or even writing me an email about a star rating. I swear I couldn't even come up with one example. I mean, put it this way, it couldn't happen in years and years and years. It's like, you know, I'm sure everyone complains about it privately. I mean, even like the Young Bucks and Ricochet a year ago, we'd kind of like make a joke about how they'd never had a 5-star match. And these guys were having phenomenal matches like all over the place. And there was even a story. Somebody wrote a song about it, believe it or not, about how the Young Bucks never had a 5-star match. I mean, which became kind of like a running gag that, like, hey, you know, these guys are best friends, but he's never given them a 5-star match. And then when I did, all of a sudden it became, because it was actually all those guys in a match in Reseda. It was one of the most phenomenal tag matches that I've ever seen, or seen at least since the 90s. There were some tag matches in the 90s that would rate at that level or better, but not since then. That it was like, they only gave it to him because, you know, the Young Bucks are your buddies. And it's just like, geez. You know, it's like, for years it was like, how could these guys be so good and you would never do that? And then as soon as, you know, but that's the role. That's the role of everything now. You know, everyone's going to look for their underlying reason for every single thing. You know, but wrestlers complain. I mean, aside from, you know, like those guys in jest, no. I mean, that doesn't happen.
From Frank Roach, do you see a day in the near future where a new promotion could become a legit competitor to WWE in North America?
Man, that would be legit competitor at close to the same level. I would, you know, you never say never. But what it would take is like Viacom or somebody like that who just says, we are going to get into the wrestling business and we are going to own a company and we're going to fight Vince McMahon and we're going to spend, because in the end of the day, we can build a franchise between a streaming service and pay-per-views if we want to do pay-per-views and live events and wrestling's big and we can beat them and we're going to lose money at first to do it. It can be done, but no one's done that since. So unless it's that, it cannot happen because the amount of money it would take to compete with Vince is just, you know, no. Unless you're a TV station like TBS was, you know, you can't afford that fight.
From Neil Skulnick, how much longer do you expect Cena to be an active wrestler, and do you see Stephanie McMahon getting in the ring again in terms of, I guess, an active fight?
She could, you know, if it's the right story. You know, I thought that she was probably going to do something with Ronda Rousey, but that never happened. I guess it could, but, you know, wouldn't be as big as it would have been. But there was a lot of talk of Triple H, and at one point it was planned, Triple H and Stephanie against The Rock and Ronda Rousey for a match at WrestleMania, but it fell through for a variety of reasons. As far as John Cena, I sense that he will probably always have an affiliation with the company. He's going to be doing less and less wrestling as his acting career gets bigger and bigger. But I think that he'll be like The Rock and The Undertaker and people like that that will be around. I think that John will be around for a long time doing matches, you know, maybe a match here and there or something as an attraction, as long as he can physically go. I mean, he'll go as long as he can. So, you know, he's turning 40 real soon. So I don't know that, you know, how many years that is, it really depends on his injury situation.
All right, final three here, Dave. Why I don't want to assume this is true, but this is a question from Jeff Pollard. Why doesn't the WWE allow its wrestlers to appear on your radio shows?
It is true, and they don't, you know, like I said, like, we have open communication, but it's WWE is very, very controlling of its wrestlers, and they only allow them to do certain things, and you know, I remember asking a couple times and getting turned down, and maybe it's just that they, you know, then everyone would ask. I don't know. Like, they allow people to do certain shows. Look, I'm still critical of them, and it's, you know, no matter what the relationship is on the surface, I mean, it's still not covering an NBA team. And I don't, you know, maybe someday it will be, but it isn't now.
This is an interesting question from John McNally, and it's very much on the news. How have the McMahon's close relationship / partnership with Donald Trump affected employee morale, if it has indeed affected any employee morale?
That's a weird one, because obviously the divisiveness of Trump. I mean, one of the things, if you know, the thing with WWE that's interesting, because they're so aware of this. You know, it's like, you know, Linda McMahon's in the cabinet.
Right.
But if you ever, like, look at the WWE website when Trump won the election, they never said a word about it. And on Raw, Donald Trump's name is never mentioned.
I noticed that. Really interesting.
Yeah, they made a call that it's like, look, we appeal, and, you know, they appeal very strongly to minorities. Mexican Americans are their biggest demographic base by percentage. You know, not like there's more than anyone else, but by percentage, like, a Mexican-American in the United States is twice as likely to be a WWE fan than most other demographics. So it's you know, I don't know if it's 20% of their fan base. I don't know the exact number, but it's a real substantial percentage. And you know, and but every fan, you know, like they draw from all places and everything. And Trump is a divisive character, and it's just kind of like, this is a fight that we don't need to get into, so we're staying out of it. I mean, as far as, you know, they donated tons of money, but they're not going to publicize it. So I think that the feeling is, and it's true, is that people want their entertainment, and the fans will, you know, the fans are going to be fans no matter what they do. As far as, like, in the office, I'm sure there's people in the office that don't like that they're working for a company that's close to Trump. I mean, there's some. And I'm sure there's some wrestlers that are very uneasy about some of Trump's things and probably don't like the fact that Linda McMahon is, you know, with him and everything. But it's, you know, I've never heard of anyone quitting over it, put it that way.
Yeah, and probably some who actually are supportive of it.
I'm sure many are supportive of it, too. But because he's a divisive character.
Yeah, but you're I had not heard that point about the Mexican or Hispanic audience is really interesting. I had not heard that, but logically it makes a lot of sense. The WWE would be foolish, actually, to start that fight because there's money on the line.
You don't need people picketing your offices.
Correct.
Something that you don't need to do, and you don't need some fans just being furious at you for stuff that you can just avoid. It's a fight you don't need. So I mean, I think that as soon as like people were asking, like, you know, are they going to play up big? This was like the Monday after the election, and I thought, right now, if it was me running that company, I would ignore it. I mean, I wouldn't have donated to him, but that's a different issue.
Yeah.
But I, as far as the television product, it's not a fight that you want, and they chose to make the same call.
Lastly, from Ross Henderson, wrestling journalism is almost exclusively male. It's a good question. Why has it been slow to change, and what do you think the reasons are, Dave, that it has been slow to change?
Well, the thing about wrestling journalism is that you're not recruited, at least for the most part. If you look at the people who are involved in wrestling journalism, the people who made their own break, and it just so happened that of the key people, as far as I know, most of them are men. But there's absolutely no reason that it could not have been a woman in the position that I'm in or the position that Wade Keller is in. There's no reason at all. It's not about wrestling, you know, being slow to change or wrestling journalism being slow to change. This is a business where you have to create your own audience and make your own break, and you know, that's, no woman has done that yet, and they could come tomorrow and someone could, you know what I mean, it's not like Vince McMahon chooses, and it's not like I choose or anything like that. It's like you come and you know, you know what I mean, you come and you have good insight and you get good contacts, and you know, I mean, now probably you would have to join with a good website, but there's still no barrier to entry. You can start your own website, and if you're really good and you really get a lot of information, especially with social media and everything, you will make a name for yourself really fast if you have the right contacts. So there's no, you know, there's no answer other than no woman has done that yet. They could do it tomorrow. You know, I mean, and you know, so that's basically the answer.
Dave, you've given us another 68 minutes, and you've done it free of charge. So I can't love you enough for
any time
for that.
You do a great job. These were great questions.
Thank you. Dave Meltzer is the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, WrestlingObserver.com. He's also a writer for MMAFighting.com. And if you are a wrestling follower or reader, I don't have to introduce you to him. He's been probably the journalistic conscience, in my opinion, of sports entertainment, professional wrestling for decades. If you're not familiar with wrestling, hopefully this was interesting enough for you, because it's just a journalistic way to cover something that, generally speaking, for a long time, other than Dave, was not covered that way. Listen, Dave, I could talk to you for hours. I hope to have you back, 8 months, 10 months from now. We'll do a part three trilogy, and keep up the great work. And thank you once again for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks. Like I said, I really enjoy this.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Dave Meltzer. Like I said to him, I could literally go hours on this. I could talk to him about this for 5 hours. I find that world fascinating. I find covering it journalistically fascinating. And obviously, I find the creative at WWE, those who write and those who control characters, it's just very interesting. I bring my producer, Lou Pellegrino, in. Lou, I honestly have no idea if you're a wrestling fan. So to me, this is fascinating. If you're not, maybe you thought this was boring, but I'm fascinated by covering something which ultimately is not physical. How do I sort of phrase this? It's not real, but it is real. The
right.
Athletics are real. The physicality is real. The storyline obviously is conceived. So it's fascinating to me how Dave covers it, because what is real is how successful is the company? How much do these guys get paid? What are the economics of it? How do the wrestlers feel about what they're doing? So what he does is fascinating, given that, yeah, it is not a sport like football in that you don't know the outcome.
I look at somebody like Dave as a movie critic, in a sense, because he's able to take you through what he's seeing, what he's enjoying, what he's disliking. Took too long to get to this finishing move. I would have made this match shorter. I would have made this match longer. Maybe this person could have come out.
Movie critics don't really get into the economics of stuff,
right?
It's usually like they're criticizing or liking the film.
Right, but I look at guys like that where he's criticizing, or not criticizing, but he's just
analyzing,
critiquing and analyzing something that's a predetermined outcome.
Right, right. That's well said.
So that's a very hard job, because I remember growing up watching wrestling, you always thought the guy who gets announced second is going to be the winner, because that's the way, that was like the run-of-the-mill joke that a bunch of us as, you know, young kids
would say. Well, usually the guy announced second was
the headliner.
Champion.
Right, of course. It was the headliner, and then there were nights where it would be a marquee matchup, so it would be Macho Man Randy Savage against the Honky Tonk Man or the Ultimate Warrior, and whoever was announced first sometimes would win. So it was like, oh, that threw that. As you get older, you're like, well, that theory goes out the window.
Right, swerve.
But to answer your original question, yes, I do like wrestling. We've discussed it a couple of times on this podcast, and we mentioned the Steamboat Savage fight in
WrestleMania
3.
Oh, you're right. I take it back. You did mention that.
You just don't pay attention to what I say.
Attention.
You're sitting across from me, but you're not looking at me.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, I was...
That's my own terrible upbringing.
No, but I was fascinated by that, because, yeah, I love anytime you're able to pull the curtain back. Listen, I know how old I am. I know how old I was when I thought wrestling was real, and then I realized, oh, okay, this is, to use my term from before, predetermined outcomes. But the theater, the soap opera, the action, the athleticism, all of that is real. Look at guys who are either in the WWE or who are retired. They can't walk. Their fingers are crooked. They have knee problems. They have hip problems, as he talked about the Undertaker.
Right.
I mean, these men and women take a beating, and it's all for us. And I love the fact that there's somebody like Dave and somebody like Conrad Thompson and somebody like Bruce Pritchard who are there just peeling that curtain back and just letting us in on some of these great stories.
Right. That's well said. And we didn't even get into like the great at wrestling expressions, you know, work, shoot.
I love this. Still, and I know people Swerve. Are going to kill me, kayfabe, babyface,
heel,
put them over.
Put them over.
Like,
right.
I know some love of that. The terms because.
No, that's
of
a lot.
Just,
you just dropped a lot of them on.
But my problem is I don't know the definition of some of them.
Well, you
I've
know what? Kayfabe is sort of the reality that they've created. They're
right.
always in character.
Right.
All right. Well, my thanks to Dave Meltzer. Previous podcasts have been Laura Gentile, the senior, what is her title, Lou? Let me get this on here.
She is the senior VP of ESPNW and Women's Initiatives.
How did you know that, Lou?
Because I
impressive.
Wrote the description
wrote
and title.
Nice. Seth Greenberg of ESPN, the college basketball analyst. Brian Anderson of Turner Sports, the fine play-by-play announcer for baseball and football. And Jim Trotter of ESPN, also a Hall of Fame voter. So those are the last... four coming up, we'll have Jim Miller, the ESPN author, for like an hour of sports media nerding out, and some other podcast guests that we will announce heading forward. Thank you very much for supporting this podcast. Lou always wants me to remind you of this. Please go to iTunes, and if you like this kind of content, please subscribe, leave a review. Obviously, we'd love you to leave a five-star review in the Dave Meltzer parlance. That helps both the podcast continue. And, you know, where it ranks on iTunes, quite frankly, has a lot of value both for Sports Illustrated and digital media. So that's why if you like it, it really does have meaning. It doesn't just go into a vacuum. So for Lou Pellegrino, for the folks at digital media, for everybody at Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.